Texas decided that it would throw its own lot in with the insurgencies of the Black Civil Rights Movement and the Mexican-American Civil Rights Struggle. That was a controversial move, and everyone likes to wrap themselves in the Civil Rights Movement and in Martin Luther King and whatever else, but all of these were very controversial, and especially the idea that activists would engage in illegal sit-in demonstrations or protests in the street or employing other sorts of tactics and rhetoric that many in their own communities actually found much less than respectable.
Welcome to this week's Labour History Today podcast. This is Patrick Dixon. This week, the Labour Radio Podcast Network, of which Labour History Today is one of over 70 members, took to Facebook to live stream election coverage from a Labour perspective on Sunday, Monday, Tuesday, Wednesday and Thursday evenings. To catch some of the great interviews with a stellar array of guests, I'd recommend you check out the Labour Radio Podcast Weekly if you haven't already. This is available at labourradionetwork.org, your one-stop shop for Labour content from working people for working people. On today's show, we're going to take you back to Thursday evening, where we spoke to historian Max Crockmore, who finds historical parallels in the interracial progressive coalition that's continued to grow in the Southwest, and the Labour Civil Rights Coalition from earlier in the 20th century. First, though, Rick Smith celebrates the birthday of Dorothy Day on this week's Labour History in Two.
I'm Rick Smith, and this is Labour History in Two. On this day in labor history, the year was 1897. That was the day that Dorothy Day, a leader of the Catholic worker movement, was born in Brooklyn, New York. As a young girl, her family moved to San Francisco. Her father lost his job as a sports writer due to the devastating earthquake of 1906, and the family relocated again to Chicago. In 1932, she met Peter Morin, and together they founded the Catholic Worker Movement, a faith-based social justice effort. The Catholic workers opened what they called houses of hospitality to serve those in need. Dorothy helped to co-found the Catholic Worker, a monthly newspaper that became a voice for poor and working people. While writing for the paper, Dorothy traveled and visited with some of the most exploited workers in the country. She talked with migrant agricultural workers in California and was arrested for supporting the United Farm Workers in 1973. In 1940, she visited the Hooverville encampment in Seattle, Washington. Dorothy's reporting vividly demonstrated how her faith informed her activism. She wrote, quote, "The rain poured down, underneath was mud, ankle deep, and the long lane that cut between the rows of shacks reflected the gray clouds in its pools. But Christ is there. I thought sadly, there in the mud, in the shacks with his poor, with them he is trying to find a place to lay his head. With them he hungers, and with them he suffers fatigue of body and soul. Behold, O God, our Redeemer, and look upon the face of thy Christ. There in the dumps, among the creatures who still are men, have pity on them and on us who permit such things to be." Like what you hear? Check out more at laborhistoryin2.com.
That was Rick Smith of The Rick Smith Show. Now we turn to our interview with Max Crockmore on the Labour Radio Podcast Network's Thursday night live stream on Facebook. Besides Chris Garlock and Alan Weirdak of this podcast, you'll also hear the voices of Jeremy Waugh from the Break Time Breakdown podcast in Louisville, Kentucky, Steve Zeltzer from Work Week in San Francisco, and Gene Lance, host of The Workers Beat on KNON in Dallas, Texas. We hope you'll enjoy the interview.
I'm really pleased to be joined by Max Crockmore, Professor of History at Texas Christian University and the author of Blue Texas, The Making of a Multiracial Democratic Coalition in the Civil Rights Era. Thanks for joining us, Max.
Thanks for having me. Good to be here.
There's been a lot of attention on the Southwest and the strength of the Democratic Coalition there. Many people have paid a lot of attention to the Hispanic vote in Miami, but our colleague Gene predicted a couple of nights ago that Texas would remain Republican, and it has. Looking at everything that's going on, what do you make of it? What is the state of the progressive coalition in the Southwest?
Well, that's a good question. I mean, I think it remains to be seen. But, you know, my friend Gene was on point, you know, that despite some optimism coming from national circles, certainly the scene here in Texas was much more uneven and even terrifying, right, depending on which parts of town you went to. or what neighborhoods and counties. But you know, I think, you know, there's just so much going on there, right? The first, we start with the Latino vote, right? And we know that that is actually an incredibly diverse and unstable category or attempted block. So that's the first piece, right? So what we're seeing in Arizona, right, is that young Latinos in Maricopa County, right, as well as down in Tucson, that they're, you know, they've come out in huge numbers and they're doing a lot of organizing. And I think, you know, we can kind of draw a straight line from SB 1070, right, to what's happening now in terms of young people there organizing and really turning out as progressives, right? In contrast, there's something going on in South Texas, right? We see in South Texas that Trump has done very, very well in 2020, much better than he did in 2016. And I think we'll be spending a lot of time trying to figure out why that happened. And, you know, right now we're starting to know the what, but certainly not the why. And what we see is that, you know, Trump campaigned there, right? So that's different. Trump didn't campaign there 4 years ago. But I think, you know, it may be that the cleavage has more to do with education level among Latinos and whites, you know, both, as opposed to purely about ethnicity or even class. So yeah, there'll be a lot of unpacking to go there. Of course, African Americans turned out heavy for the president everywhere, including in the Southwest. It's not for the president, excuse me, for Joe Biden, including in the Southwest. And, you know, the you know, Black women everywhere represent the you know, really significant center of any progressive coalition, you know, within the Democratic Party and beyond. We see, you know, that Black women are supplying much of the leadership, much of the good ideas. They're doing a lot of the grunt work, a lot of the spade work, a lot of the shoe leather. And you know, that's paying dividends in places like Georgia right now. You know, and so, of course, labor plays a role historically and continues to play a role. But, you know, I think we've seen that most clearly in Nevada, right? From what we can see in Clark County, I think it's really clear that Joe Biden's going to win Nevada. And it's once again because of the strength of labor and Latino and Black voters who are tied to immigrant rights and tied to labor there in Nevada pushing that needle. So, you know, and of course, California is California. So it's an interesting moment. And, you know, had Texas flipped, we'd probably be having a really different conversation. But I think either way, what we know is that the Democratic Party is one thing, and the coalition of progressives and labor-minded people and civil rights-minded people is really something else. And I think we'll continue to see the tension between the different wings of the Democratic Party in the years ahead.
A lot of folks in that area of the country, if I understand correctly, were more favorable toward the Sanders campaign. Is that right?
Well, I mean, not enough to carry him in any of the primaries here, right? But yes, certainly on the ground, you know, the social movement people, the labor people, you know, Bernie had overwhelming support here. And, you know, there's, I think, a vibrant and flourishing left coalition in Texas and other places. But, you know, what we saw nationally was that Bernie reached a point where he became a front runner, and very quickly the forces of capital and of so-called moderation rallied around anybody they could find to stop him. And they found Joe Biden. And it seems that that experiment, that gamble might work, that he may be elected. But right, I think the reason why Joe Biden didn't win in a massive landslide, as some polls thought he might, as folks on the coast thought he might, the reason that that didn't transpire is that he hasn't had much to sell working people. His record isn't all that good. And he doesn't have a clear politics in the way that Bernie Sanders does. And so, yeah, you know, I think we would not be chewing off our fingernails right now if Bernie Sanders had been the candidate. And you know, I think particularly in places like Texas, right, where the Democratic Party's been irrelevant for decades, it's not going to suddenly find relevancy by saying the same old thing.
Do you see, when you're looking at these coalition builders in the present era, do you see any mirrors or parallels between the period in which you've written about?
Yeah, sure, absolutely. So, you know, I don't want to give you the whole book talk, and it's a rather large book, but I wrote a book called Blue Texas, The Making of a Democratic Coalition in the Civil Rights Era. And it kind of surveys the history of how labor and civil rights activists on the left started organizing separately as far back as the 1930s, and over the course of several decades found one another, not because of any sort of natural affinity, but rather some mixture of desperation, self-preservation, and ultimately just discovering that coalition building could become their secret weapon in their separate struggles against Jim Crow, against what I call Juan Crow, and also against, you know, capitalist domination of the Democratic Party and local politics. So, you know, that story, it took lots of twists and turns. It took several decades of trial and error, sort of experimentation. But one critical development was when organized labor in Texas, under sort of new leadership, decided that it would throw its own lot in with the insurgencies of the Black civil rights movement and the Mexican-American civil rights struggle. And that was a controversial move, right, at the time. You know, we look back now, right, and everyone likes to wrap themselves in the civil rights movement and in Martin Luther King and whatever else, but all of these were very controversial, and especially the idea that activists would engage in illegal sit-in demonstrations or protests in the street or, you know, employing other sorts of tactics and rhetoric that many in their own communities actually found, you know, much less than respectable. And so organized labor, you know, went out on a limb and made a close alliance with the most militant African-American and Mexican-American activists. And they were able to build power together in the streets and also at the polls. And they launched massive voter registration and get out the vote campaigns that ultimately did transform Texas politics, you know, particularly at the urban scale, but really statewide. So that's the quick version of the history. So are there parallels? Absolutely, right? I think what we see in cities across Texas, and I think throughout the South and the Southwest, so going both directions, like, you know, Georgia is becoming more like the Southwest, parenthetically, right? It's becoming much more diverse. So to get back to it, right, what we're seeing is that, you know, Black Lives Matter activists, immigrant right activists, LGBT activists of color, the DSAs in the South and the Southwest are very much doing good anti-racist work and showing up. Some of the remnants of the Indivisibles and some of the other kind of progressive groups that came together. And then, yes, labor, right, are all working together in the cities. And, you know, Gene's at the thick of it in Dallas and some really good work happening there. But we've had successful living wage campaigns across Texas. We've had successful campaigns for paid sick leave and for private sector employers that, of course, our state government has since tried to preempt. But the you know, the organizing's there and it's vibrant and exciting and I think really promising.
Thank you. Alan Weirdack, I think you had a question.
Sure. So I was kind of wondering with, you know, looking at Texas and labor and the Democratic Party in the 1930s, Texas became a right-to-work state in 1941. So I was wondering if you could talk about what happened there in 1941 between the Democratic Party and labor and Texas becoming a right-to-work state. And then fast forwarding into the present, how, you know, trying to repeal right-to-work at the national level and also at the state level. I think of conversations that are happening to repeal it in Virginia. So I guess, you know, taking the past and putting it into the present, do you see any efforts from the DSA or from labor to attempt to overturn right to work in Texas?
Yeah, so, okay, there's a lot of parts there. So I think it was a little later than 41 in that, you know, Taft-Hartley is the enabling legislation that really makes right to work happen, right? And in Texas, there was a, you know, a virulent right-wing politician and in Papio Daniel that emerges during the war and you know, bounces back and forth between the Senate and being governor. And so he really led the charge there on behalf of what my friend George Green calls the establishment in Texas politics, right? The economic elites. I mean, the Democratic Party in Texas has been fragmented really since the 1930s, right? Maybe even earlier, I think even earlier. But we see a clear fissure develop in the 1930s between the New Deal loyal liberal Democrats and the establishment, right, of the Democratic Party, which, like its counterparts across the South, you know, are mostly committed to capitalist development and white supremacy. And so they, you know, the Dixiecrats, the segregationists. And so that splits there. And it's, you know, Texas, and the labor movement emerges rather rapidly in Texas in the 1930s and gains a serious foothold in industrial areas, right, in the refineries and the steel mills and the defense industries, right? So, you know, Gene's later employer emerges during World War II and is quickly organized by the UAW in the aerospace industry. And then you see, you know, a bunch of other sort of flare-ups of militant unionism. So yeah, when, you know, even before the war is over, there's a serious counter-offensive on the part of big business to try to roll that back here as elsewhere. And it was in part because the threat of the CIO PAC was so intense, right? The CIO PAC really moved hard in the predecessor in 44 and then 46. And they managed to capture quite a number of congressional seats, a bunch of local offices. Of course, it was interracial. It was tied with the left-wing Progressive Party by 48. And so there was just this spate of anti-union legislation, including a mass picketing law that prohibited mass picketing and defined a mass picket as more than two people within 50 feet of one another. So it was pretty bad in Texas, right? And Right to Work was one piece of that. And of course, there was a group, Christian America, a bunch of like the national engineers of Right to Work and a bunch of the backlash at that moment were coming out of Texas as well. What efforts are underway now to repeal it? Honestly, I'm not real sure. Maybe others may have know more about that. You know, we're not going to see any changes in the Texas legislature as a result of this election. You know, a place like Virginia might be able to do it. And of course, we've seen that Right to Work has had a really negative effect in Michigan, and you know, the rollbacks in Wisconsin have had a negative effect on the labor movement. That said, I personally think that the whole Right to Work question is a bit of a red herring for us. And as a movement, you know, I grew up in Nevada, and you look at Nevada, and when I was a kid there, it was this right-wing state, and now it's this good left-wing state, and it's because of labor, and because of immigrant rights activists, and because of civil rights activists, and, you know, none of them had the protections of a closed shop, right? And in some ways, right, labor gets lazy when they have a closed shop, and we've seen the consequences of that in different junctures in history. So for me, at least, you know, we also saw, you know, in 2008 and 9 with the election of Obama, labor just poured all this energy into the Employee Free Choice Act and has nothing to show for it. And so I'm just not sure that labor law reform needs to be our top priority right now.
Let's go to Steve in California, and then we'd like to hear from Gene in Dallas.
Yeah, well, I think, you know, Texas is important, and I think that a couple of things. My union, the CWA, is organized in the University of Texas. There is organizing going on all over Texas, so with a right to work law. So it hasn't stopped workers in Texas from organizing. Maybe you can talk about the effect, the racist effect, these attacks, the massacre at the Walmart, what that's had on the Latino population, and what the role of the unions have been in defending Latinos in Texas, Mexican Americans in Texas, and has it changed the political dynamic in Texas?
Yeah, good questions. So yeah, I mean, Texas, of course, you know, is heavily Latino, right? And the state government has been attacking immigrants left and right. So, you know, we had a SB4 in 2017, which was a new show me your papers bill passed by the state legislature, you know, that forced police to ask for identification and a bunch of other terrible provisions, right, in the name of fighting sanctuary cities. And that was, you know, on top of really decades of organizing around the DREAM Act and other sort of incremental reforms, it was a real catalyst for organizing in a lot of places, certainly where I live in Fort Worth. You know, it led directly to a bunch of young people building a mass movement, right, in the city, in a place that really hadn't seen one in a long, long time. And so we've seen, you know, really exciting, vibrant immigrant rights organizing happening, very creative work. You know, we have here locally a struggle against the 287G immigration enforcement agreement that our county has entered into. And that's an ongoing battle that we're waging every year, it seems like. And we just ran a candidate for county sheriff who did not win, but he was pledged against it, and we did pretty well with it. So I think that the organizing will continue. You know, when El Paso happened, it sent just shockwaves, you know, and terror and fear through many Latino communities in Texas and beyond. And, you know, I think that organizing, we saw folks, you know, coming out and having vigils, but also very directly saying, you know, this election or this larger picture is really about an attack on our very being, our right to be, our ability to be here, you know, in Texas at all. And of course, many Latinos pointed out that, you know, the border crossed them rather than them crossing the border. So there's all of that, right? And I think one area I found really encouraging is that there has been growing labor support, right, for undocumented workers across the board. In Texas, our state labor federation has worked very closely with the Workers' Defense Project, which is, you know, an alt-labor worker center organizing people in the construction industry, mostly undocumented workers who've been very successful at fighting wage theft and also fighting for prevailing wage ordinances in Austin and now Dallas and Houston. And so that's a major step forward. You know, labor has achieved some victories. Unite Here has organized a couple of hotels in San Antonio that, you know, are heavily Latino. And so that's another point of convergence. And then actually the state teachers union, the AFT, has been really wonderful about putting their money where their mouth is and really devoting resources and energy into hosting citizenship schools to help people who are able to naturalize actually go through the process to, you know, doing the voter registration work, to hiring Latino organizers. And, you know, now the State Federation does have as one of its top officers, you know, a dynamic young Latina organizer who came out of that teachers union. So that's really exciting to see, you know, and it also has close ties with other immigrant and civil rights activists in the state. We're also seeing really exciting examples of Black-Brown solidarity taking place in Texas. And I think that's just another area in which, you know, labor could potentially tap in terms of doing that work. You know, I guess I would say the one, this is a bit of a digression maybe, but the one area in which labor is sometimes too quiet for my blood is around Black Lives Matter. And I think that there's still ongoing fear about alienating the prison guards unions under AFSCME in Texas, as well as the police unions. But, you know, I'll just say the police union is not a union, right? It's got far too much overlap historically with, you know, white terrorist organizations for me to see any possibility of solidarity there. But yeah, so big picture question, big picture answer. You know, there's a lot of great organizing happening with Latinos, and labor increasingly is showing up and participating and backing those efforts.
If we could just go to Gene Vance. What do you think, Gene?
Well, first of all, I think that the labor movement is doing pretty well on Black Lives Matter. One has to really appreciate how far backwards we really are in Texas to understand the difficulty of going forward. Now, Max is not sufficiently promoting his book, but this is a really good, it's a handbook on this very, very difficult task of forming progressive coalitions under extremely difficult conditions. And just on right to work, we talk about that every election, during the election, and then you never hear another word about it until the next election. Mm-hmm. Don't forget that right to work was invented in Texas. We were right to work before everybody was right to work. They didn't even call it right to work, you know. It was really the anti-closed shop until the term right to work, which was a big PR coup for the bosses. And that term was invented right here where I live, right down there at the Dallas Morning News. They brag about it. They're happy with themselves for having done it.
Chris, I think you also had a follow-up.
Yeah, I just wanted to follow up, Max. I wanted to hear more about, you know, I lived in Austin for a couple of years, which, you know, some of the true Texans would argue is not really a part of Texas, but I would like to hear more. Exactly. Yeah, it's the third coast, right? No, but about labor law reform, because people are already starting to talk about that. And you know, I am very skeptical. You know, it's this sort of mirage or holy grail, and it comes up every time people, you know, start to think that we're getting anywhere. And I mean, besides the fact that it looks like a long shot that we're going to get the Senate, and in which case, if we don't, you know, it's dead on arrival. But you seem to be implying some, you know, more fundamental criticism of this idea that labor law reform is going to solve all of our problems. I'd like to hear more of your take on that.
Yeah, well, thanks. I mean, it's somewhat poorly developed, but, you know, I'll say, just looking at recent history, you know, starting in the late 70s, labor has put a lot of effort into labor law reform and gotten very little back from all that work and all that money and all that lobbying. And it clearly matters, right? I mean, I used to be a union organizer. I know it matters when you can get, you know, an NLRB election in some cases, or when you can, you know, have certain protections, right, that you're covered under the act. But at the same time, I think what we're seeing is that workers, there's always been a lot of, I mean, back up, there's always been a lot of drawbacks to that, right? So by creating the regime of collective bargaining, right, it was always also about containing labor militancy, right, and about directing you know, shop floor conflict off of the shop floor, right, and into the boardroom and into, you know, industrial peace so that production could continue. And then, of course, labor agreed to the no-strike pledge during World War II, and that further sort of separated rank and file from labor leaders and just made the strike that much more of a hard tactic to use. Obviously, labor gained a lot from this agreement, from this peace, this relative peace. But I think the more that historians dive into it, we learn that this alleged compact between labor and management during the 40s and 50s just never existed. You know, that they were always fighting tooth and nail, and they kind of, for a minute, maybe bided their time and worked on some deep background work. But as soon as they were able to lash out and hit hard again, they did. And really the whole time, right? They management resisted workers at every turn. And, you know, the labor law clearly still matters. Like, we need better labor law. My friend Lane Wyndham's wonderful book, Knocking on Labor's Door, right? It really shows this in such clarity, right? That, like, the issue has not been that workers don't want to organize. The issue has been that the state has allowed management to run roughshod over them, and there's been no meaningful penalties. So that's all there, right? That's all true. It's a real problem, and better labor law might help fix that. I just don't think we're going to get better labor law through the normal legislative channels, even if the Democrats had a large majority in the House, larger than they will have, and you know, and a majority in the Senate. And so I think, you know, the other part of what Lane, you know, gestures toward in the book is like, well, how else can workers be organizing, and how else should you, what other shape should unions take, and how else can we actually build a working class movement that produces power for working people of all backgrounds? And, you know, right. And yeah, the teachers are another example, right? So yes, what we see all over America is that the teachers are walking off and building strong organizations, even in states where they have no rights. And, you know, I think more of us need to follow that example and say, I don't, you know, it doesn't matter if I'm a covered worker or not. And, you know, and of course, Unite Here years ago abandoned the NLRB processes, right, to great effect. And so, you know, I think when we're talking about building shop floor worksite unions, we need to think of radically different ways to do that. And, you know, go back to some of the industry-wide or sector-wide strategies. You know, I'd love to see a broad-based organizing in retail that was, you know, focused on some, you know, the centers of our new cities and actually building power at the zip code level or the block level rather than workplace by workplace, as, you know, one approach. The work that Workers' Defense Project is doing is really wonderful in the construction trades, because the old trades really haven't worked at organizing the new workers in those industries. So, you know, I would say it's not, I don't know. Obviously, like, to the extent that we're doing legislative work, we should push for this. But I'm just not sure the Democratic Party will ever get us there either. I mean, I'm really encouraged by, you know, the work that Working Families is doing as a way to try to bore from within a little bit. And I think also the DSA and their sort of dual electoral strategies of, you know, running candidates and also just trying to push everyone. You know, why can't we have a Green New Deal party right now? Right? It seems like this is the moment. And so, you know, maybe that's where we should put our effort, is actually mass organizing and solidarity with immigrants and with folks who are fighting for meaningful criminal justice overhauls, for abolition even.
Alan, I believe there's a comment that you'd like to
there present. There is a new comment, and I'm just going to read it verbatim. It's a little bit long. Max, it is directed to you, and it says, regarding the 40s and 50s, we also can't understate the lasting effect of the massive expulsion of communists from the American labor movement, especially around Taft-Hartley. So the AFL-CIO style unions in the 50s and 60s lost or abandoned class consciousness and the corresponding militancy in their relationship with the bosses. So basically, when the bosses are business partners, the galvanizing possibilities of class-based militancy through unions is totally stifled. When these bosses are considered enemies, the possibilities are great.
So sure, the anti-communist purges had a huge impact. And, you know, one of my labor history professors back when I was an undergrad, she said, you know, that the labor movement in the late 1940s shot off its left foot and has been running in circles ever since, right? And so that's certainly one way of thinking about it. You know, that said, right, I think that even as labor grew somewhat more, you know, more bureaucratic and self-satisfied, certainly by the later 50s, you know, there were all of these possibilities, all these other groups of workers organizing and pushing the labor movement in new ways. Right, again, as Lane's book shows, but also we see, you know, we see the rise of the farm worker movement. We see, you know, public sector unionism, we see, you know, people really trying to expand and do dynamic work and it working right all over. And my book documents this a lot too, right? That there are these moments where civil rights movements and labor movements come together and really become one. And where labor goes beyond its historic work at the workplace to really become advocates for the whole working class in their communities. And so, you know, to the last point, like, yeah, I mean, we clearly have a massive like educational project, right, to help people think about their bosses in different ways, or the fact that they work for a living in a different way, and that means that they fundamentally don't have power, right? And that even when it gets to our, you know, elections, that their power is circumscribed. And but yeah, I mean, I don't think we have to tell everybody you got to go hate your boss, right? But the real question, I mean, bosses are bosses, but I think the bigger question is, you know, how do we actually have a democracy, right? How do we actually build power for working people in a way where we actually have a say over our lives, where we can come together and debate things and make decisions without having, you know, the collective boot of the bosses on our necks. And, you know, we're people, I think, are waking up, right, to the ways in which the police have their boots on the necks of people of color in America. But I think, you know, we still have some work to do to try to, you know, make plain that, you know, as long as we have concentrated capital in the way that we currently have it, we're not going to have meaningful democracy in America or worldwide.
I do appreciate your time joining us today, Max. This is Max Crockmull, the author of Blue Texas, The Making of a Multiracial Democratic Coalition in the Civil Rights Era.
Thank you all. I appreciate it. Good work and keep it up. And I hope to join you again someday.
That's all we've got for today. We open the show with Las Nubes from Little Joe Hernandez y La Familia, and we're leaving you with Old Blue by Chris Horgan. You can subscribe to Labour History Today on your favourite podcast app. You can be a part of the show by reading an item. Just send us an email at labourhistorytoday@gmail.com. Labour History Today is a member of the Labour Radio Podcast Network, working people's voices broadcasting worldwide 24 hours a day. Our show is produced by the Metro Labour Council's Union City Radio, the Kalmanovitz Initiative for Labour and the Working Poor at Georgetown University. The Labour History Today team includes Ben Blake, Chris Garlock, Leon Fink, Sherry Lincoln, Joe McCutton, Evan Papp, Jessica Polzak, and Alan Weirdak. For Labour History Today, this has been Patrick Dixon. Stay safe, and don't forget to thank your local letter carrier for delivering postal ballots. See you next time.